Midwestern cities like Detroit, Chicago, and Milwaukee are among the most racially segregated urban areas in the country. And they're just a few of the many cities with high rates of segregation. Our next guest says that didn't happen by accident. Instead, it was the result of decades of intentional decision-making. She writes that as a result of cities being designed to limit African Americans to certain areas, geography itself has become a major dividing line in society, and that it's time to abolish and repair the unequal system it's created. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history of major cities and how they were designed and racially segregated? Has this been an issue in your own life, in your own community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Cheryl Cashin is a professor of law, civil rights, and social justice at Georgetown University. She's the author of the new book, White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity Hoarding and Segregation in the Age of Inequality. Cheryl, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
We think of division and disparities by income level, by race. What led you to focus on geography, the space of our communities?
Well, I have spent 25 years of my academic life studying residential segregation. I also worked in the Clinton White House on community development. And this book is the result of these decades of writing and thinking about this. And I also, frankly, I have an undergraduate degree in electrical engineering and I'm a self-taught historian. I took a systems analysis to this. It took me a long time to figure it out, but there's no other way to understand the persistence of racial and economic inequality in this country without understanding the central role of geography. And I say, we have a system of residential caste where government overinvests and excludes in high opportunity areas and disinvests and contains people and frankly preys on them in high poverty neighborhoods, particularly high poverty Black neighborhoods. And we have a mythology often used in politics that tells stories about the people in the hood to justify the way things are. And the biggest myth of all is that high income living is earned, high opportunity living is earned, and hood living is the deserved result of pathological behavior. When in fact, favored places, high opportunity favored places are subsidized by the overwhelming majority of people who are excluded from those places through their income, gas taxes, other taxes. People of all colors and classes who live elsewhere help pay for the roads, sewers, and golden infrastructure in these low poverty, resource rich places. And, you know, the thing you have to understand is the hostility to the 6 million Black great migrants who migrated north and west from the South in the first 7 decades of the 20th century is what created residential caste. And you know, everybody's ensnared in it, but it's animated, it persists to this day, and it's animated by three anti-Black processes: boundary maintenance, opportunity hoarding, and stereotype-driven surveillance.
Growing up in the 70s and 80s, it seemed like segregation was just a part of the landscape. Maybe it had evolved naturally. It's just the way things were. Part of the story you tell is decision-making from the federal government down to a local neighborhood group that put this into place. Can you talk about this segregation that we see now as the result of that really conscious process of decisions?
Right. You know, in the first two thirds of the 20th century, beginning in the 19 teens, going straight forward through the 70s, racially restrictive covenants, exclusionary zoning that limits where multifamily buildings can be built, urban renewal projects that pushed out Black residents, intentionally segregated public housing projects, an interstate highway program intentionally laid to create physical barriers between the Black and white sides of towns, And then endemic redlining, you know, marking Black neighborhoods from the 30s as not worthy of government-backed or government-insured mortgages, as well as just disinvestment in basic services in Black neighborhoods, in schools, roads, sewers, such that the distressed conditions in Black neighborhoods tended to be, began to be associated with the Black people who lived there. You know, that's the history. But I fast forward to today. The federal government continues to invest in segregation. It subsidizes the construction of affordable housing, about $10 billion a year through its low-income housing tax credit program. That subsidy is built mostly, you know, those units are built mostly in poor communities that already have their fair share of affordable housing, right? Only a fraction of affordable housing gets built in high opportunity neighborhoods with high performing schools and easy access to jobs. I could go on, you know. Our former president, Donald Trump, when he was campaigning in 2020, bragged in the summer of 2020 about rescinding a regulation that was designed to implement the Fair Housing Act of 68, the requirement, the legal requirement that all localities that receive federal funds must affirmatively further fair housing. And he tweeted about, you know, congratulations, you know, I've saved your, you know, beautiful suburb from low-income housing. Thank me, right? So, you know, the overt policy of the Trump administration was to promote segregation. But, you know, we still have very little accountability from the federal government for the spending it does in enforcing the idea embodied in the Fair Housing Act that all communities are supposed to be promoting open housing. And there's still a lot of on-the-ground resistance to it.
We're talking to Cheryl Cashin about her new book, White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity Hoarding and Segregation in the Age of Inequality. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you see segregation in your community? Here in Wisconsin, we have some of the most segregated cities in the country by many standards. What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. Cheryl, you mentioned opportunity hoarding as one of the three processes that keep segregation and its impacts alive. Can you talk about what it is, first of all?
Well, it's the fact that wealthy neighborhoods enjoy the best public services, environmental quality, private and public and natural amenities, while all other communities are left with fewer, poorer quality resources. That doesn't happen naturally. It's because elites tend to bend public policies to their will, and they tend to get more than their fair share of beautiful in infrastructure, you know, and beautiful amenities. And we tend to disinvest elsewhere. I don't have specific data for Milwaukee, but I do for Chicago. And for example, a 2019 study found that in Chicago, which is also very segregated, public and private investment get white neighborhoods received three times the public and private investment that majority Black neighborhoods do. In Baltimore, which frankly has had something like seven or more Black mayors and has a majority Black representation on its city council, they did a study of where their community development dollars were going, and they, to their own horror, they found that they were spending four times as much money in white neighborhoods than majority Black ones. And this is, you know, a consistent practice. So that's opportunity hoarding. And again, the people excluded from high opportunity areas are subsidizing all of that beautiful infrastructure.
We're talking to Cheryl Cashin, professor of law at Georgetown, author of the new book, White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity Hoarding and Segregation in the Age of Inequality. You can join in at 800-642-1234. 1234. What questions do you have about the history of cities ending up segregated along racial and economic lines and the impact that's had? Do you notice a divide in your community or where you're from between the wealthy area and everyone else? Are there solutions you think need to be put into place? We'll get into that in just a few minutes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Cheryl Cashin, author of the book White Space, Black Hood, looking at how cities created wealthy and poor neighborhoods largely along racial lines, the impacts that has, and some possible solutions. And Cheryl, I want to get into that now. We've touched on some of the history and the problems this segregation has created. I want to spend a chunk of time, though, on some of your suggested answers to it. And you have kind of two categories, rescue and abolition. And I want to start, repair and abolition. And I want to start with repair. What do you mean when you talk about repairing these neighborhoods we're talking about?
Well, let me say first that the beauty of understanding the systems of residential caste and the practices is that once you understand it, the way forward becomes rather obvious. You just need to dismantle those anti-Black practices. So you were interested in repair or abolition. I can't remember which one.
I want to do both. Let's start. Well, you were leaning toward abolition there. Let's go for it. What would that look like, reversing some of these practices that put us where we are today?
Okay, so investment and greenlining of historically defunded Black neighborhoods rather than disinvestment and economic predation. All of the Black neighborhoods that were marked with a D, marked as hazardous with the redlining maps of the 1930s, that's the Federal Housing Administration. Most Black neighborhoods where great migrants landed were marked as D, and I read the history in Milwaukee and that all of the Black neighborhoods in Milwaukee, and they included a lot of Russian Jews were in some of those neighborhoods too, but they were marked as D, and immediately, even in vital Black neighborhoods, disinvestment and decline starts. And the Fed recently issued a study which found that 8 decades later, those very same neighborhoods experience disinvestment, decline, segregation, distress that can correlate with that original D. So they should receive priority if any new infrastructure money is forthcoming, or if any, you know, with community development funds.
Who would need to take the lead on that? Is this something that would have to come from Congress and the White House? Could it be neighborhood by neighborhood? Where would that come from?
I actually raise up the example of an organization in Milwaukee called Liberate MKE, which went through a citizen budgeting process among Black citizens of Milwaukee, where they identified their priority investments, which was, you know, nothing unusual, violence prevention, not tied to excessive policing, affordable housing and jobs for youth. And they proposed that some money be reallocated from policing to their priorities. And, you know, they were shocked when they found out that the city of Milwaukee was spending almost half of its budget on policing, right? I'm not arguing that that policing should be defunded or abolished, but you could, a number of cities have looked at their own budgeting processes, gone through a neighborhood equity analysis, and decided to give priority to neighborhoods that have historically been underfunded, right? So it could be that you create a strong, progressive, frankly, multiracial movement for equity in budgeting on the ground, and you don't have to wait for the federal government to come in as some kind of savior, right? There are cities that are doing that. Minneapolis, Seattle, Baltimore, they all now have a requirement of racial equity analysis. Joe Biden, within hours of being inaugurated, issued an executive order ordering analysis about racial equity across federal budgeting and put the formidable Ambassador Susan Rice in charge of it. So that's one area, you know, that's the opposite of opportunity hoarding. Another, you know, a big boundaries are, you know, both residential boundaries and school boundaries are a huge contributor to segregation. So ideally, every city should have a mandatory inclusionary zoning ordinance rather than an exclusionary one. And I hold up the example of Minneapolis, which repealed its single family zoning ordinance. Every neighborhood in that city now has to be open to more denser development. You know, California has repealed it in the sense that all neighborhoods now have to be able to receive duplexes. It's a baby step. But these are examples of, I guess you could say, both abolition and repair, disruption of, you know, of long-held processes that are fundamental to residential caste.
Before I run out of time, I do want to get into one example of repair that you give in the book. This one from California, a community that had a very targeted effort aimed at, in this case, it was violence prevention. Can you tell us about that? Because it was a story that I don't think I'd heard before.
Richmond, California had one of the highest homicide rates, gun violence rates in the country, higher than Chicago. And they were so desperate to try something different. They took an innovative idea from a guy named Devone Boggan, who had been not involved in violence prevention, but youth development, right? And he figured out, the police knew who was pulling the trigger. It was about two dozen young men. And what he figured out, he saw them with a lens of love. He saw himself in them. And he said, why don't we create a peacemaker fellowship, an 18-month fellowship, go to these guys, offer them a chance at something different. And the fellowship gave them a 24/7 mentor, a life map where they basically said, what do you need to have a different life? Do you need a GED, a driver's license, a job, cognitive behavioral therapy, drug treatment? Do you need to just get out of here, you know, travel, right? And to a person, almost every young man who was offered this deal took it. And the theory was that the people pulling the trigger or likely to are potentially the most transformative change agents, right? So he saw them as assets. And in fact, he got a foundation to give them, if they met their life plan, a 9-month stipend, $1,000 a month. Gun violence fell by 55%, right? And for an initial appropriation of $600,000 from Richmond matched with philanthropy, which is a heck of a lot cheaper than what Chicago spends about $1 million per inner city block in that city to incarcerate people, right? So my final point, this is abolition and repair, transformation, is once you change the lens from presumed thug to presumed citizen and see people as potential assets in their own transformation, it frees you up to focus on evidence-based strategies that actually may be more effective and cheaper than just trying to contain and incarcerate people that you have you fear.
In just our last half a minute or so, do you see that mindset changing in that direction you were just talking about?
I think in progressive cities, we see it happening, right? We had 20 million people protest last summer. Yes, I know that there was, you know, riots and a lot of problems in Kenosha in Wisconsin, but we had 2,500 peaceful protest across this country with people raising signs saying Black Lives Matter. It's died down, but I still see the signs everywhere. And I think in cities, particularly, that draw people who are open to difference, it is possible now to get a majority to support more innovative strategies that heal rather than damage, that include rather than exclude.
We'll leave it there. Cheryl, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
That's Cheryl Cashin, professor of law, civil rights, and social justice at Georgetown University. We've been talking about her latest book. It's called White Space, Black Hood: Opportunity Hoarding and Segregation in the Age of Inequality.